When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Battleground 44 with me, Saul David, and Patrick Bishop. Today we're talking to award-winning historian Richard Overy about the Eastern Front. Richard is an honorary professor of history at the University of Exeter and the author of many brilliant books on the Second World War, the Soviet Union, and Nazi Germany, including Russia's War, The Dictators, Blood and Ruins, The Great Imperial War 1931 to 1945, and the forthcoming Why War, which is out in June. So we're going to talk about 1944 and the developments on the Eastern Front, but just to set the scene, can you give us a little bit of a resume of what's happened in the previous year, and that really since the big turning point, I suppose, which was the Battle of Stalingrad, that ends in early February 1943, and how much has the line moved since then?
Well, I've never seen Stalingrad as quite the turning point, I think, that other people see. I mean, to me, the turning point for the Red Army comes at the Battle of Kursk in July 1943. It's the first time they confronted the German army in summertime, campaigning weather, and resoundingly defeated the Wehrmacht. The Wehrmacht, after that, was always in retreat. And that's really, for me, the critical turning point. Red Army had a lot of lessons to learn, and they'd finally learnt them by the summer of 1943.
Can I just ask you about that aspect, Richard? Because it is extraordinary, isn't it? By the time we get to what we're going to be talking about mostly today, Operation Bagration, the Red Army has gone from being this, you know, blundering, incompetent, you know, completely sort of incapable of reacting to the shock of Barbarossa. And by early 1944, there's been this complete turnaround. It's undergone this transformation into being this, you know, hyper efficient, but certainly in terms of planning, in terms of deception, in terms of getting into the minds of the enemy, etc. It's a total transformation. How did that come about?
Well, the Red Army did change its performance, but it was largely thanks really to Stalin, I think, who came to acknowledge himself the mistakes he made in the first year or so of the war. And the Red Army, it decided the only way it was going to outperform the Germans was to learn from them. And so they spent a lot of time in 1942 assessing what the Germans did and why it was so effective, and then tried to apply that more and more to what the Red Army did. Take two examples. One was the use of armour. They very soon realised that the Panzer Division, which was an all-armed division, of course, infantry and tanks and armoured vehicles, was a very effective military unit. So they reorganised the main frontline units to mirror the Panzer Division. So they had armoured divisions too, with infantry, anti-tank weaponry, etc., and artillery. Let's take another example. Air power in the Soviet Union was useless in 1941, even though they had a huge air force. They spent a lot of time reorganizing the air force, realizing what they were doing wrong. Simple thing was no radios. Putting radios into Soviet aircraft made a huge difference. And they reorganized the way in which they controlled aircraft at the battlefront. That's just two examples, but it was a long learning curve, but they realized they were not going to achieve anything unless they learned some lessons.
And I suppose the crucial thing is that they were actually allowed to do that. So Stalin does make this, you know, extraordinary for a dictator really to admit that he doesn't know everything. Completely the opposite of Hitler's approach, of course, and that gives them the environment in which they can actually get on with the job of soldiering.
Well, yes and no. I mean, Stalin was a great interferer. He carried on interfering right the way through. But he did recognize that the things he'd asked of the armed forces in 1941 and 42 were unrealistic. And so he relied more and more on the general staff and on particular figures like Zhukov or Vasilevsky, the chief of staff, to outline the plan, and he would then understand it and then approve it. So there was a big change at the top as well. You know, Stalin realized that he too was not, you know, a natural born military leader. So the opposite from Hitler. Hitler gets more and more involved, right down to the nitty-gritty, doesn't trust his staff. Stalin moves the other way, begins to trust his staff more and more, and to intervene less and less at a lower level.
Richard, can you tell us a little bit about some of the key players, certainly in terms of the battlefield fighting? We've got right at the bottom von Manstein, who's commanding Army Group South. I mean, the German forces, I suppose, in very simplistic terms, are divided into three army groups. So a little bit about the characters on both sides. Manstein, I mean, he's faced by Vatutin and Konev, if I recall rightly. But also give us a sense of the scale of this conflict, the sheer numbers of people involved.
Well, this is a vast canvas, the Eastern Front. You know, we focus a lot in the West on D-Day or North Africa. North Africa is a handful of divisions. You know, there are 220 German divisions, there are 250 or 300 Soviet divisions. This is a colossal battle across a front line more than 1,000 miles wide. In fact, what goes on at one end of the front line is quite different from what's going on at the other end. Huge numbers of tanks and armored vehicles, huge numbers of aircrafts, huge numbers of artillery pieces compared with what the West has to mobilize. It's one of the things that always strikes me, I think, about the conflict on the Eastern Front is how just simply in terms of management had difficulties. For commanders at the top or for commanders at local level, you're having to manage a huge and increasingly fluid battlefield. You need to know a lot. You need to understand the limits of what can be done. You need to ensure that logistics work. And the more you think about that, the more you realize that, you know, managing a battle on this scale is in itself a contribution to victory. The Germans don't manage it so well from 43 onwards because they're on the back foot. Logistics are incredibly difficult. They have partisans in their rear all the time cutting their communications. They're increasingly filling their divisions with less well-trained novices, many of whom don't have time to learn the ropes before they're being pushed back again by the Red Army. So we need to see this battlefield as a vast arena in which commanders often going to be at sea, but the more you can manage the battlefield and understand how to manage it, the better. And on the Soviet side, there are some remarkably good managers. Zhukov, of course, is the one that always stands out. Partly, of course, because he wrote his own memoirs, which painted him in the most favorable light possible. But there are others, and I think the one I admire most is Antonov, who is the deputy in Moscow, deputy chief of staff, most of the time serving Stalin directly. And he's a very bright guy and understands the nature of the battlefield, what needs to be done, where reserves need to be put in, and so on and so on. And then you've got Vasilevsky, the chief of staff, who's another extremely able strategist, sent out by Stalin, in fact, together with Zhukov, in 1944 to the battles on the Eastern Front, because he sees them, you know, as for what they are. They're very effective battlefield commanders.
Richard, I think we just need to remind everyone that the beginning of 1944, it seems late on in the war, but the Germans are still quite deep into Soviet territory, aren't they? So what you've already pointed out, that it's really backwards all the way for the Germans from this point. So the most of the offensives are being launched, of course, by the Soviets. What are their strategic objectives at the beginning of 1944? What are they hoping to achieve?
Well, I mean, Stalin and the Soviet government, what they want is to expel the Germans from Soviet territory. And indeed, many of the junior commanders think that that's really the limit when they get to the frontier. Some of them stopped at the frontier thinking that was, you know, all that Stalin wanted. But Stalin's, you know, come to recognize that to stabilize Eastern Europe and to provide the Soviet Union with the security he needs, he's going to push on. In fact, he thinks he's going to have to push on all the way to Berlin. Otherwise, you'll never get the Germans to finally surrender. Also, you've got the West pushing now from France, and he worries a bit about what that will mean to his security. You know, they're allies, but on the other hand, you know, Allied armies, Western Allied armies penetrating deep into Central Europe. What does that mean for Stalin? So for Stalin, the ambition moves from simply expelling the Germans, which is, you know, the priority, to thinking about consolidating the Soviet Union's security position in Eastern Europe. And that's exactly what happens. It begins in 1944 and is completed a year later.
So by the spring of 1944, they're actually now thinking about pushing westwards up to the Vistula at least. And this is where the decision has to be made. Where is the big push going to come? At which point along the line are they going to concentrate their forces and execute a deep battle maneuver? Can you say something about how that question was considered and how the conclusion was arrived at?
Well, the Soviet General Staff and Stalin spent a lot of time thinking about this. Stalin, of course, is all for aggression, but he, as I said before, recognizes that there are limits to what he can ask. But what they plan at the beginning of 1944 is a series of rolling offensives, starting in the north, going down to Belarus and Ukraine, and then offensives in the south. Later on, they recall the 10 Stalin offensives to give the impression that Stalin thought it all up. But these 10 offensives are really designed to roll back the German line from the north to the south. And doing it in sequence actually works very well because the Germans are confused about where the main thrust is going to be. They keep thinking, should we send our reserves up there or should we keep them here? And as a result, the German management of their battlefield in 44 is much more muddled than it usually is because they're uncertain where the main thrust is coming. Now, the plan, of course, is that the main thrust will come in Belarus and Ukraine. And Belarus particularly, because that's the one area where the Germans are still in strength, deep inside Soviet territory. For Stalin, that's a priority. Clear them out of Belarus. And then beyond beckons Poland, and in the end, Berlin.
I'm always intrigued by the name of the operation, Bagration. Bagration, of course, was a Georgian prince who fought in the Napoleonic Wars. He was badly wounded at Borodino and died subsequently of his wounds. But is there a particular significance in that name reaching back into the Tsarist past, which you would think would be antithetical to the whole kind of, you know, communist mindset? Is there anything you know about that, why that name was chosen?
Well, they hadn't got a name for it, and they were worried. So Vasilevsky and Zhukov asked Stalin, can you think of a name, please? And Stalin, of course, is deeply embedded in the Russian past. And it's no accident that he chooses a Georgian to act as the code-word for this campaign. And he has, Stalin, he thinks about the Russian past. He thinks about Russia as a great power. And for him, calling it Bagration is not anti-communist, it's a sort of recognition of the realities of the Russian past. He's quite happy to admire the, Russian generals throughout that Napoleonic campaign. There are other operations named after them. But Bagration is Georgian, and it just may be that Stalin thought, here we are, Georgian and Georgian.
So Bagration is launched, Richard, in June, and it's timed to coincide, of course, with the D-Day landings. I mean, it takes place a little bit after. In fact, I think the intention was to launch it specifically on the third anniversary of the German invasion of the Soviet Union. This, of course, would be the big revenge. I think it actually takes place a day later. Is that right? But can you give us a little bit of a sense of how the offensive unfolded?
Yes. If you focus on the biggest offensive of these 10 offensives, that is Bagration, clearing Belarus of the Germans. Now, Stalin wanted it to start earlier, actually, in May. I think he quite wanted it to preempt the Allies, in fact, to show that the Soviet Union was on the move where the Allies were not. Although as historians have talked about Stalin agreeing to launch an operation that would support what was happening in D-Day, I think the evidence for that is very thin. He wanted an operation, series of operations on the Eastern Front, regardless of what it was the West did. But in the end, because of technical problems, logistical problems, it had to be postponed until the 22nd. On the 22nd, they have spoiling attacks, they have reconnaissance in strength, heavy bombing of the German lines, and indeed the operation is launched on the 23rd of June. And of course, it's used by Stalin in the weeks after that to contrast how effective the Red Army is in pushing the Germans back at 20 kilometers a day with the Western Allies stuck in the blockage in Normandy for weeks.
Okay, that's all we have time for. Do join us in part two when we'll be hearing more from Richard Overy on the Eastern Front. Welcome back. This is what Richard Overy told us next.
Can you tell us something about the scale of the fighting and the nature of the fighting? This is an interesting statistic, that 20 kilometres a day advance. What would it actually look like?
Well, the attack on Army Group Centre, which is what Operation Bagration is, it was an attack that moved forward very rapidly, but it did get held up in places, as one might expect. You know, there were German units that were more effective in holding up the Soviets. But what the Soviets wanted to do was what the Germans had done to them in 1941. They wanted to open up breaches in the German front and then push the armour and infantry support through that breach and move on, leaving the infantry to tear up the pockets of German resistance around. Because what they wanted to do was to encircle the Germans. They wanted to do to the Germans what had been done to them in 41. And that meant you had to move pretty fast. Occasionally they lose control, command and control over the units and so on, but on balance it's a much better campaign, organised campaign, than almost any of the other major Soviet offensives. They do achieve what they want. They break the line, they push units through very quickly, they encircle Minsk, and they have the Germans firmly in that cauldron. They encircle other major cities, and also garrisons there which Hitler has ordered to stay put are stuck. They're surrounded as well. And that's really the pattern of Bagration, different from the fighting further south later on. The pattern is that they want to try to show to the Germans that they can do what the Germans did to them. And poor Army Group Centre doesn't have any panzer divisions. So, in fact, it's extremely difficult for them to counter the way in which Soviet armour is being used, because German intelligence told the army that the main thrust would come south towards Romania. And there were 14 panzer divisions in the south expecting the operation, and almost no armour in the north to counter the Soviet thrust. So the speed of the Soviet thrust is partly a result of the poor level of preparation for Army Group Centre, the poor level of supply, the poor level of armour. And it is an extraordinary campaign. In a matter of weeks, they've swept up all the Germans. They completely annihilated Army Group Centre, and they're pushing on towards Poland. The contrast, of course, with what was happening up till then on the Western Front is quite remarkable, and Stalin and the Soviet press made the most of it.
So the German confusion was in part due to Russian deception, Maskirovka operations, which they turned out to be remarkably adept at using in order to confuse the Germans about their true intentions.
Yes, I mean, deception was something which the Red Army thought a lot about it, even before the war. And, you know, deception just seemed to be one of the arms of, you know, battlefield strategy. You know, you had to wrong foot your opponent, and that gave you all kinds of advantages. They did it remarkably, of course, in Operation Uranus, which surrounded Stalingrad. They did it at Kursk. They did a remarkable job, though, with Bagration. It had to be kept absolutely secret. It's quite extraordinary. I mean, you know, train drivers were put on trains, you know, loaded with ammunition and sent off, not told where they were going. Just told, you know, keep going on this track, don't ask questions. Only five people in Moscow actually knew the details of the whole plan. It doesn't mean the plan didn't come together, of course, because each unit had its own orders and so on. But the overall plan, nobody knew. They then set up dummy airfields, dummy tank parks and so on in the south, very much like Montgomery, actually, Alamein. And they had anti-aircraft guns there and fighter patrols to give the impression that this was, you know, where the bulk of the Soviet effort was going to come from. All the stores and supplies, the oil, everything was moved in at night. Vehicles had their tires muffled and so on. Every effort was made to make sure that the enemy did not know what was happening. Now, on the ground in Army Group Centre, you began to get a whiff of what was going on. And they made some effort to persuade Hitler's headquarters that actually we actually might be going to be attacked. And they said, no, you're not. And Galen, the head of Army Intelligence East, said, expect a calm summer, which I think is probably the biggest intelligence blunders of the Second World War. But it was partly because of, you know, extraordinary efforts at deception, which the Russians really were experts. And that meant that, you know, when the attack came, He came with a force and a power that Army Group Centre had never even imagined, and plays a, you know, a very important part, of course, in the initial victory.
So the Russian performance is improving, as you've explained, Richard, and if anything, the German performance is going the other way, partly because, of course, the loss of a lot of material. You mentioned the fact that the panzers were in the wrong place. You've also written about the bombing war. To what extent was the Allied bombing war and the fact that the Germans were having to devote a lot of resources to combating it having a real effect on German performance on the Eastern Front? I mean, in particular, with regard to things like aircraft, I mean, they were heavily sort of outnumbered in terms of aircraft, but also these other key things that the Germans had used so effectively earlier in the war, anti-tank guns, anti-aircraft guns too. I mean, how big a difference was the bombing war making for the Germans?
Well, it's always difficult to estimate that. I mean, the most important thing was simply is that fighter aircraft are being kept in the Reich. 80% by 1944 of the fighter force is in the Reich. There's very little of the fighter force in the West against the Western Allies, and a rather limited fighter force, bomber force in the East. And clearly that does make a difference. So it's striking how effectively the Germans can dig in defence, even when they haven't got, you know, they're not protected by air power. Other things, well, if you look at, you know, vehicle and tank, anti-tank production, that goes up rapidly in 1944. It's a peak year, in fact, for the Germans. So I don't think we should exaggerate the extent to which the bombing war diverts resources. If, of course, there'd been no bombing war, then Germany would have had more resources. But then we also have to ask the question, you know, would they have felt the pressure to produce more resources? The bombing put pressure on them. And, you know, as a result, they expanded production enormously in the year between autumn 43 and autumn 44. Yes, of course, it makes a difference. But as I said, I think we shouldn't overstate it. One of the things the Germans have, of course, is very effective anti-tank weapons. Handheld weapons, of course, but now three extremely good anti-tank weapons. Those are being produced in huge quantities because they're easy to produce, and they are being distributed in large numbers to the Eastern Front. So, in fact, you know, despite the success and the speed of the advance, the Russians take very heavy tank casualties in Bagration and in the operations later on in the Ukraine. Very heavy casualties. One major armored division takes 80% casualty, loses 80% of its tanks. Largely because the Germans are very good at anti-tank warfare. They're not so good at tank warfare, but they've got the hang of anti-tank warfare. So this is, you know, it's an enemy that's being pushed back. The Red Army now is huge. Its air force is huge. Its tank park is huge. It's probably impossible for the Germans to stop them. But the Germans are still a, you know, an effective fighting force. You know, we know from Bagration, it's nearly another year before they get to Berlin, before the capitulation comes.
Richard, can you say something about what's going on in the minds of the German military high command at this moment? What do they think their sort of best case scenario is if they can, you know, conduct an orderly defence? Where do they think they're going to end up?
Well, the German high command is in a very difficult position in 1944. They've got Hitler constantly saying, hold ground, hold ground. Turn towns into, you know, basically into fortresses and defend them to the last man. I mean, all these are pointless things. And so the Army High Command in particular is having to cope all the time with a commander who's asking them to do, you know, absurd things. While on the other hand, they want to be able to withdraw to some kind of firm defensive line. Every time they build a line, it gets overrun. I think for the German high command, the only thing they can hope for is that they can hold up the Red Army long enough, withdraw to Germany, and perhaps establish a better defensive line there. But, you know, in the minds of the senior commanders, it's a pretty hopeless task. Walter Model is sent off to the Eastern Front to try and stem the tide. He's a realist. He recognizes he can't be stemmed. He's then sent by Hitler to France to see if he can stem the tide there, and he writes back and says, you know, we can't do it. We've got to retreat. And Hitler hates this idea. And thanks to Hitler, it's almost certain that the Allies advanced more rapidly in the West and in the East than they would have done.
And finally, Richard, or at least final question from me, are we seeing anything similar in the current war in Ukraine in terms of the Russian army, which performed pretty poorly, let's face it, to begin with, learning from its mistakes and learning on the job, as it were? And 2 years into the war in Ukraine, certainly there's a lot to play for, but Russia does seem to be on the up, both in terms of battlefield performance and its sort of wider strategic objectives. Can you see any similarity there?
Well, I mean, it's tempting to find similarities. I think the problem is we know so little about the war. We know so little about what's happening in Russia, about Russian planning or thinking. We really know zero, in fact, about the way in which the Russian high command has reacted to the situation. We can infer, perhaps, that they are learning, but it's a slow process. If you look at how slowly they're moving forward, even to take a completely ruined city, as they've just done, it's a very slow process. I mean, it doesn't look like the Red Army of 1944, that Putin, no doubt, would wish it were. I think that against a weaker enemy, the Russian army will in the end prevail. And in the end, we will probably say, well, they learned a more effective strategic approach. But at the moment, I think we have to hold fire. We can't be sure of what's happening in Russia. We can't be sure of how effective these changes are. And we can't be sure that they will, actually win.
Thanks very much indeed for talking to us, Richard. Really, really enjoyed that.
Well, that was fascinating, wasn't it? Do join us on Friday when we'll be hearing all the latest news from Ukraine and answering listeners' questions. And also next Wednesday when we'll be having another episode of Battleground 44. Goodbye.